And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Nature has the capacity to evoke and provoke passions within most of us, especially those who tie their deepest feelings to the wild creatures. In just a moment, we explore the realms of the passionate warriors as we look at whales, riders, and woodpeckers, and the people who forge beyond the boundaries of ordinary man. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Humanity is either drifting into uncharted waters, or perhaps is more like rocketing into the unknown as the 21st century looms before us. We drift because we seem to have lost our plan. The usual visions and dreams, like democracy in Iraq, aren't so clear-cut, don't necessarily carry the human spirit that once it did. And rocketing, as we are on a natural trajectory, that we may be incapable of changing much, as the power and energy unleashed in the 20th century launch of the modern age now pushes us into a new world of rising oceans and global warming, mass extinctions, and to a large extent, we will just have to go along for the ride until we find a new and more powerful technology to lead us onward. Sometimes, the best way to know where we may be going is to watch for the trends, which can morph into trendy, which may have the good fortune to become fashionable, which then leads the masses along until the fashion changes. Well, the good news for all of us is that nature and a passion for nature are becoming interesting and even somewhat okay and perhaps even trendy. Getting on board the ark to the land of sustainability carried on the winds of global warming, is definitely becoming fashionable. And until it is abused, this can only serve us, and if we are smart, we'll ride that wave for as far as it rolls. Today, we're going to visit a few passionate warriors as we talk about a nature riding workshop in our third segment and get brought up to date on the latest fieldwork coming from the Choctahatchee swamps in the quest for that elusive ivory-billed woodpecker thought to be extinct, but recent reports of its existence are engendering great passion, particularly in the team led by Dr. Jeffrey Hill. We'll cover his latest discoveries following the news and continue into our second segment. But today's news is really a feature, which relates directly to today's theme, as this week, in the waters of the southern Arctic Ocean, passions collided, literally, as pro-whaling and anti-whaling forces faced off in a most amazing story, which we'll get into right now. And what played out in the Arctic Oceans may be likened to an off-Broadway play of great consequence. The stage. The cold, sullen blue oceans which hug the Antarctic. The actors. The legendary eco-warrior Paul Watson in the role of captain of his ship, the Farley Moad, along with his supporting actor Captain Alex Cornelison, commanding his ship, the Robert Hunter. They have come to the vast open Arctic in the hopes of finding the Nishin Maru, pride of the Japanese whaling fleet, which hauls up and flenses the great whales it catches into blocks of meat and blubber, oil and blood. In the name of science, they seek out, harpoon, and drag hundreds and hundreds of whales that live in these waters, set aside by the world as a sanctuary from slaughter, to allow the great creatures to recover from the blind greed of centuries that decimated the once great pods to light the lamps of the world. In Act One, Captains Watson and Cornelison forge their craft into the open seas to find the whaling fleet. For 5 weeks, they churn their craft, ever searching, And then, Act Two. The chase was launched, and once undertaken, the great whaling armada took flight, with the Nishan Mara full steam away. But the Farley Moat, no small vessel by any standards, kept at the chase, and the whaling ships abandoned the whales to take flight, avoiding entering the ice, as they call it, where ships become toys on the Arctic stage. But the great Captain Watson had done this all before. This was his passion, saving the whales, and he'd run alongside the whalers, ensnarling their props with nets, fouling their decks with rancid butter bombs, and over the years, no one had ever lost a life on either side. And in the pursuit, Zodiacs were enlisted, small craft, launched to tease and tattoo the whaling vessels. But in the fray, a Zodiac craft broke down amidst the fog and snow of the frigid fray, and drifted off unknown to the captain's all, drifting into the fog. And as fate would have it, in this moment, the phone went dead on the little tiny Zodiac. And their silence, the silence of lost sailors at sea, rang out like a chant from the souls of all lost sailors. And silence fell to the battling Titans as all ships, yes, all ships, held fast to take a break to find the lost sailors. Hours passed. 3, 5, 7, 8. And then the men were found. And then they were saved. And so the truce was ended. And as with any great chase in the wild, the pursued are eventually cornered, up against a threat of ice in this case, and blocked from escape by the Farley Moat and the hunter. It was the Kaiku Maru that was being steered into the ice and faced with the ancient fate of being beaten, the Japanese captain running full steam with the Robert Hunter veered starboard, and the great ships collided in a slow-motion grinding and ripping steel plates and nerves. The ships were slapping each other like schoolyard boys, afraid to throw the first real punch that would ignite the pride and fury that fists ignite when pain and passion collide. And around the world went out, "Fight! Fight! There's a fight in the Arctic!" And the great ancient parents came running to break it up. And the great ancient parents were forced, finally, to speak out, to stand up. And the great nations shamed the Japanese for loving whales in soups and in cans more than free and in the seas. And the principals of the schoolyard, the New Zealanders, in whose waters the fight erupted, agreed finally to protect the helpless beings in their charge. And the battle was drawn. And the sea shepherds retreated, battered but finally honored by a world that hoped this would all just go away. But it won't, for the world is awakening to the songs of the giant souls that seek sanctuary from the slaughter, so that they may raise their young and live their ancient lives, thrill the human soul, and express the will of the divine in the ways we may never really understand. Thank you, Captain Watson. Thank you, Captain Cornelison, for standing up for the rights of the living, even on the vast small stage of a cold and distant place that few would ever ponder in the raging seas of change within which we drift until someday we find our way back to the garden, back to an Eden so crafted in love. And that's the news. And a few reminders. If you have a story to tell, a passion to share, contact me here at the Wildside News by sending me an email to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. We'll be glad you did. Now, continuing on with our stories of the passionate warriors, we drift Atlanticwards to Florida, where a curious passion is being lived out in some ancient and remote swamps. It's an update on the search for the ivory-billed woodpecker. We're into February here, and spring is in the air, at least in some areas, not in others. But in some areas, yes, spring is beginning to appear, and with that come increases in certain bird activities and migrations and movements and things. And certainly one of the areas where people are most interested in what may be happening in that realm is in an area in the panhandle of Florida, the Choctahatchee River area, because Dr. Jeffrey Hill, who is joining us now, has set up a crew based on graduate students and other people to head down to that area to try to determine whether or not that elusive, supposedly extinct, ivory-billed woodpecker is, in fact, not extinct. Dr. Hill, welcome back to the Wild Side News.
Hey, Sydney. Thanks for having me on again.
Yes. Last time we talked, you'd gone down to that area. You picked up some sightings and soundings, and we'll talk about those, which inspired you to really head back into that area, and certain things you perceived suggested that there was a good reason to do deeper research. And so we're going to talk about that and find out where you're at. Let's talk, first of all, about the ivory billed, and just give a brief history. And I encourage listeners to go back to a previous show, which we have on the show page here, to get the background. But just give us a brief reintroduction to the ivory billed, and we'll lead into where you're going now.
Okay. This is a very large species of woodpecker that lives in southern swamp forests. And it was widespread, if not relatively common, before the Civil War. And this was largely because the southern swamp forests had remained pretty much intact up till the Civil War. But after the Civil War, northern corporations got their eye on the southern swamp forests and started harvesting this resource. And over the next decades, into the early 20th century, they basically cut all of the cypress trees and many of the other swamp species trees out of these southern forests. And as the swamp forests were cut, ivory bills became scarcer and scarcer, rarer and rarer. And then as we get up into the early 20th century, there was a lot of interest in natural history collections. And both professional museum people and rich amateurs basically put out a bounty on the remaining ivory bills, and shooters went through the remaining swamp forests and ivory bill populations and just about shot every bird. So coming out of the early 20th century, ivory bill woodpeckers were largely thought to be extinct, although they were never officially declared extinct by the Fish and Wildlife Service. There was no definitive evidence through the second half of the 20th century. And then in 2005, the Laboratory of Ornithology at Cornell University announced that they had discovered at least one bird in Arkansas in the Big Woods area there along the Mississippi River, and that they had video as proof of the existence of one bird. And it was really their announcement that got us poking around a little bit in South Alabama and the Florida Panhandle, and we stumbled into a population of ivory-billed woodpeckers on the Choctahatchee River.
By the way, what's the update on the lab's work on the ivory bill? I haven't heard much about it.
Well, they were very frustrated in Arkansas and being unable to relocate the bird that they photographed in 2005. And the probable explanation is the single bird that was in the Cache River during that spring moved elsewhere, either died or moved. And with that bird gone, the Cache River is a relatively small area. There were no ivory bills left to pretty easily locate. Uh-huh. And so the idea is that these birds may still exist in the White River bottomlands, which is a vast forested tract south of the Cache River. And their investigation and search for ivory bills in the White River area continues. Cornell is also trying to spearhead a continent-wide search for remaining ivory bill habitat and remaining ivory bills. And so a lot of their effort now is focused on having search teams kind of jump around the country going from one possible ivory bill site to another.
Of course, the great big twist on this story is the fact that it had been 40 years at least since the last time there was a definitive sighting of an ivory bill. And then you kind of wonder, well, after 40 years with no sightings, how could it be that there's possibly only a couple of birds left? It doesn't make sense because they have to...
these are the things that's the skeptics have really latched onto. But, you know, these southern swamp forests are bigger than people appreciate.
Yeah.
They were cut over, but in many areas they weren't clear cut. They were the big valuable timber was taken out, but forests were there before the cutting and there after the cutting, and very few people with book knowledge of birds ever get near these southern swamp forests.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've talked to people who have fished and are part of a continuous lineage of fishermen and hunters along the Chuctahatchee, there seems to be a fair bit of knowledge of the existence of ivory billows. It's not a surprise to the local people.
People there are reporting that they do see them.
Yeah, after the fact, we had never had any reports of that Chuctahatchee. But now as we go around, it's not uncommon to run into a local fisherman who has very little awareness of our search or what's going on, but will tell you, oh, yeah, I've seen these birds my whole life. You know, they used to nest down there, and then they were up there, and they give us good descriptions. They seem to know these birds.
This is a definitively significant bird because it's a very large, very...
Well, it's large, you know, but for a non-birder, I think sometimes how fantastic this bird is maybe a little bit overstated.
Could be, yeah.
You know, it's not like a whooping crane-sized bird.
Right.
About a crow-sized bird.
Well, I know I've run across pileated, or pileated, whichever they are, woodpeckers, and walking in the woods, and I'd never seen one before, and the first time I saw it, I went, what in the world is that?
You're very aware of outdoors, and so ivory bill is slightly larger than a pileated, and for somebody cued into birds, you say, wow, that is a big woodpecker.
Yeah.
For someone with no interest in birds, it's like, huh, there's a bird.
Right.
I don't think it would stop the non-bird enthusiasts in their tracks screaming, oh, God, look at that bird, which is sometimes the way this bird is portrayed. It's a heck of a bird for someone paying attention to their environment around them.
Well, also, they look so unique. They look almost dinosaurial.
If they're close on a tree next to you, they have the herky-jerky movements. Yeah, that catches people's attention. They do look pretty interesting when you get a close view of them.
Now, I'm talking, of course, about which is the proper pronunciation?
Pileated? I say pileated, but... I'm self-taught birder, so I probably pronounce it wrong. I hear both from expert ornithologists. That is an English word. Probably could look it up in the dictionary.
Yeah. Well, we'll say pileated.
Get a correct pronunciation.
We'll say pileated just because it's easier.
Yeah.
Pileated sounds a kind of fancy.
Yeah. I'm not fancy, so I just stick with pileated.
Let's move up, because what you're now looking for is the ivory billed, which is a little bit larger version and has distinctive patterns, which, of course, is what birders are always looking for. Give the definitive distinctive patterns for the ivory billed.
Okay, ivory billed is larger than pileated, in length maybe 10 to 20% larger. It's more massive, though. It weighs substantially more. And ivory billed basically has a lot more white in its plumage than pileated. Although this is tricky because pileated show a fair amount of white, and people consistently misidentify pileated as ivory billed because they see the white.
Well, that's the conflict.
The big difference is on a perched ivory bill, the lower half or lower 30% of the back is gleaming white, sort of like a red-headed woodpecker perched. On a perched pileated, there's very little white, a little patch of white at the base of the primaries. So if you get someone who has some ability to describe the birds they're seeing, and it's funny how people will misdescribe a bird right in front of them, but if someone is a reliable describer of birds, if they note a large patch of white on a perched bird's back, that's a very distinctive appearance of this bird.
Well, that's the critical bit of information a person needs. Of course, then they have these extraordinary beaks, long beaks, and then the crest.
That's right.
Yeah.
But most of those characteristics are shared with pileated.
Yes, they
pileated
are.
Pileated tend to have a darker bill, but it can be fairly light, never ivory color, but fairly light, and especially if the sun glints off it can look quite light.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not as good a character. And then the crest, they both are crested woodpeckers, so it gets tough beyond the white on the back. For people that aren't experienced bird watchers, that can take detailed notes on the bird.
Okay, well, there you have it. So if you're out in the woods, you see a large woodpecker, and you notice the white, you're probably becoming part of history. The white back. Lots of white
back on a perched bird. There you go.
Okay, well, that's what people, keep your eyes open out there. Well, let's talk about what you've done since we last talked. You mounted quite an expedition to the Choctahatchee River area. And tell us about how you got out there and what's been happening since then and how you're going about your field research.
Yeah, well, this year we've got Brian Rolek back. He worked as just a technician last year, but he's now my graduate student. And I recruited another graduate student, Rusty Ligon. And so Brian and Rusty run the field crews. And our field crews consist of about 10 paid searchers. So these are mostly college kids, although not all college kids. Some older people came in to be part of this. And they basically are paid to be in the swamp all day, every day, trying to get a picture of ivory-billed woodpeckers.
So you've got about 20, 30 people out there?
No, closer to 15 people.
15 people, okay.
Yeah, with counting me and Dan Mennell and our two grad students and a couple people doing the sound work, it's closer to 15. And then we don't work 24/7. We basically work during a week. Everybody gets 2 days off.
Mm-hmm.
So at any one time, there's closer to 10 or maybe a few under 10 in the swamp at any one time.
And then how big an area are they distributed over?
Well, we're trying to cover about 12 square miles.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it seems like an enormous crew down there, we sometimes feel overwhelmed. We have a presence of less than one person per square mile most days. So a lot of people have raised concern that maybe we have too heavy of a presence in the swamp, we're saturating the swamp, and it doesn't feel that way most days. One person per square mile is not a very heavy presence in that swamp.
This a square mile is a big area.
Is a big area, yeah. Especially in a swamp.
Yeah, exactly.
A square mile in a salt flat is pretty big. A square mile in a flooded forest feels orders of magnitude bigger than an open field or something. It's so hard to move, no line of sight. And a square mile can feel like an enormous area.
And obviously the nature of sound in those areas as well must be very different.
Yes, very different. Very hard to locate. Sometimes you hear the double knocker Kent, which you suspect might be an ivory bill, and everybody thinks, well, just run towards it and get a picture. Well, it's tough. Usually there's deep water channels between you and the bird, or you're in a boat and there's dry land between you and the bird, and it's just tough to move quickly through this habitat.
So you have your field workers out there. They're living in tents. I mean,
that's right. We work out of remote tents. Mm-hmm. We have a generator, so they do have electricity, but that's it. You know, no running water. We just have pit toilets that we dig, and they're really living in a remote camp situation.
I think it's great. If I were in a different situation, probably a lot younger and a lot more able to do whatever I wanted to do, I'd be out there with you. I can't think of anything more exciting than that level of field work. And you pay these guys. I mean, they're paid.
Not much, but they do get paid.
$1,200. I tell you what, for sitting out in a tent, there's not a lot of way you can spend your money out there.
Low overhead.
Know?
So yeah, I mean, I wish I had more nights in the camp. That is a really fun atmosphere.
Yeah.
Because they're very enthusiastic. Group of people, hardworking, and the nights around the campfire cooking dinner in our little kitchen area is really an enjoyable time.
Well, we've painted a picture. Now let's talk about what they're out there doing and how they spend their days and what you're finding. And we will, when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
History is being discovered with each passing day,
as a scientist leads a team of dedicated field and laboratory researchers into the myriads of sounds and sightings collected in the swamps of the Choctahatchee River. Our update with Dr. Jeffrey Hill continues when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News. We now hear Dr. Jeffrey Hill of Auburn University talk about what he and his team are discovering in their historic quest for the legendary ivory-billed woodpecker.
Well, we really have two activities. We're trying to do a systematic survey of every tree in the forest for woodpecker cavities, large woodpecker cavities. So we have divided our 12 square miles into linear transects 50 meters apart, that each have to be walked by a person looking up and looking for holes in trees. And so this is something like over 1,000 transects that have to be walked or paddled or however we can get through them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very labor-intensive work. You have to get down the transect, try to look on each tree, and then if you find a hole that seems 3 inches or larger in diameter, then you have to put a metal tag on the tree, and get out a data sheet and write a description of the cavity,
mm-hmm.
Score it for how promising it looks, and then move to the next one. So this has taken a lot of our time.
Talk about the importance of the cavities, too,
well,
what you'd be looking for.
These birds sleep in a cavity every night, and then they're obviously going to raise their young in a cavity. So a cavity is one place where we can pin the bird down on a specific location. The cavities of ivory bills should be larger than the cavities of Pileated, the other big cavity driller in the area, and they should have a different shape. They should be more oblong. So that's what we focus on, the big oblong cavities. And when these are found by searchers, we go out and we put a time-lapse camera pointed at the hole in the tree. And these cameras will basically take pictures of that hole over a 5-day period about once every 15 seconds. Maybe we set them for a little shorter than that on cavities. But anyway, periodic pictures where if a bird landed on that tree and went into the hole, we would almost surely get a picture of it.
Now, I question, too, because I'm such fascinating work. I love field work.
Yeah.
Then someone has to look through all that stuff.
That's right, yeah. And we have a designated camera person, Jamie Hill, who actually worked on the Cornell project last year doing the same thing and worked a lot of bugs out last year. He's our full-time camera setter. And so he sets these cameras and pulls them in and brings up these images on his computer, and you basically run through these still images rapidly, sort of like a movie,
mm-hmm.
and watch for movement. And the human eye will detect the slightest movement in those frames.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we don't miss any birds moving that frame.
I do a lot of video work, and yeah, if you're watching, if you have a fixed camera on it's going to appear as a fixed thing with different lighting, but if a bird shows up, you definitely notice that.
You do. I've done some analysis of these myself, and you see everything. You pick up moths flying through. As long as it's a little difference in contrast, and a bird on a tree definitely would be,
mm-hmm.
you don't see, when you're zooming through the images, all you see is something was back there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go back and find that image and then realize what it is. But yeah, you wouldn't miss the bird.
In terms of your monitoring these cavities, have you had any successes that you're aware of to date?
Well, we haven't gotten a picture of an ivory bill, or we'd be more excited. We'd be publishing. We have gotten pictures so far of pileated woodpeckers and squirrels and other species of woodpeckers. Now, our camera deployment got off to kind of a slow start. We were getting these cameras and getting organized until just very recently. We've really only had just a few weeks of camera deployment.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
So we're not anywhere near, say, the halfway point of our camera deployments or something. We've got months of work left, so I'm not very discouraged yet about our camera deployment.
Okay.
We've got a lot of big holes in trees to point cameras at still.
Another aspect of your quest, and we'll be following the camera work as we proceed here. You give me a call as soon as you find something out.
Yeah.
this has to do with the, what they call the double knock. And that is, as you've said, not definitive, but it's indicative that that may be an ivory-billed woodpecker, because they do have a distinctive double knock. But
that's right.
In the wild,
they're drumming like most woodpeckers. The birds in this genus, Campophilus, give a two rapid bangs, powerful bangs on a tree, boom, boom.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no other woodpecker or animal that will give two loud double raps.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, there's other sources for two bangs in the forest.
Well, what's
the problem?
How's your work proceeding in terms of the double knocks?
Oh, it's really good. We mostly try to record these using what we call listening stations, these remote recorders. And this part of the project's being run by my colleague, Dr. Dan Mennell, at the University of Windsor. He and his grad students have set, I believe it's 14 of these listening stations through the forest. They retrieve sound cards every day from these things and then analyze them for putative double knocks and putative Kent calls, the other sound that ivory bills make. It started off slow. The beginning of the year we didn't get much, but lately we've been getting pretty regular double knock and Kent call detections on these listening stations.
Hmm. Now, again, does a person have to then scan through like a wave file or something of that nature?
Well,
to...
it turns out humans are way better at analyzing visual images than auditory recording.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't sit and listen to these sounds.
Oh, right.
That would be too time-consuming. What Dan does is he digitizes the sounds and converts them to sonograms.
Sonograms, yeah.
These pictures of the sounds.
Right.
And then the students sit and, almost like looking at the Reconyx camera images, they zoom through these recorded sounds visually, looking for double knocks will be two distinct sound, vertical sound images on these sonographs. And Kent calls are stacked harmonics, a little stack of notes.
Mm-hmm.
And each sound is pretty distinctive visually. And they can zoom through pretty fast and look for these double knocks and Kent calls.
Describe the Kent call as well.
The Kent, this is another big difference with pileated woodpecker. Pileated woodpecker do this kind of maniacal laugh, loud, striking sound, whereas ivory-bill, the more striking bird, has this really boring little nasal sound they give. I can't do it very well, but it's sort of like a eh kind of sound. I didn't do that very well, but it's a nasally, simple little note that they give.
Hmm.
And the best description was one, I believe it was first given by James Tanner, who studied these birds 60 years ago. He said it sounds like a tin trumpet.
Hmm.
Kids used to have little toy trumpets, or if you take the mouthpiece out of some wind instruments like a saxophone, you can create a noise like these. But it's a very simple, non-musical, really kind of boring little sound that these birds make.
You're assembling recordings of double knocks and as well what people assume to be Kent calls.
Last year we had about 100 double knocks and 100 putative Kent calls recorded, and this year I don't know what we're up to, but we're slowly building this year again towards those kind of numbers.
Well, of course, but then people are always going to be able to question about that.
Oh yeah, we do too.
I mean,
you hear these things and they sound good and they match. There's very few recordings made, Kent calls made of a known ivory bill where the recordist had the bird in front of them. These are from 60 years ago.
Mm.
There are no recordings of double knocks from this species.
Mm.
So we try to analyze it thinking, what else could it be? How well does it match the descriptions and recordings of these things? But it's always supposition. We never know for sure that an ivory bill made these sounds because we have never seen a bird open its mouth and make them yet.
Well, now let's talk about the sightings. What's the status of the sightings at this point? And, of course, what you're ultimately leading up to is getting a definitive either video or photograph. But
yeah,
Let's talk about sightings from your crew out there.
Well, we had a few really good sightings right between Christmas Eve and around New Year's. And the best sighting was by Tyler Hicks, who was one of the guys that actually discovered these birds with me in 2005. Tyler's an outstanding bird watcher. He's now an undergraduate student in Colorado. So he was back over the entire Christmas break trying to get a picture of these birds. He had an ivory bill perched on a tree right in front of him. So he was approaching Kent calls. This is on Christmas Eve.
Hmm.
And kind of a drizzly situation. Came around a bend in a stream and had a female ivory bill perched, he estimated, 40 feet away. So that's very close. he could see details on this bird. It had a black crest, which is diagnostic of ivory bills. Pileated, both male and female, have a red crest. Only a female pileated of the North American crested woodpeckers would have a black crest. He could see the white on the lower part of the back. He could see the ivory-colored bill against the tupelo trunk. And he could see the stripes, these dorsal stripes, running down the bird's back. He had a camera in his hand, a good Canon digital SLR, but it was under his coat because it was drizzly. He pulled that camera out and attempted to photograph the bird, but of course, the bird only stayed on the tree for a beat. Then it's flying, and he's trying to snap the camera towards this moving bird, and he didn't get it.
The one that got away.
Yep, it was darn close. It was very frustrating. Mm. That bird had perched on the tree for another beat. Probably the problem was he came up on it too close. I mean, 40 feet away, he was right on top of that bird. If he had come around the bend and had been 100 feet away or 200 feet away, maybe it would have sat for a second and he would have gotten pictures. But it was right in front of him.
Everyone's going to wonder if he should be hooked up to a lie detector or something like that, because he has a vested interest in seeing this. You're going to have to keep looking and try to get that shot. Well, that sounds very exciting, and it's too bad, unfortunately, that he wasn't able to get that shot. But you're going to continue. Talk about some other sightings. Apparently, you are getting sightings.
Yeah, a few. We had a flurry of sightings. A volunteer came in and actually had saw birds in two different locations on two different days. This was all about the same time, and we also, between New Year, Christmas Eve and just after New Year's, we also had a lot of double knock detections and Kent call detections, but people hearing these. We didn't have our listening station set up at that time yet. And we thought, this is it, because this was right at the very beginning of our study.
Hmm.
The first time we ever had decent numbers of people in the forest, and we thought, well, this is going to be easy.
Mm.
All of a sudden, we got people and we got birds, and then it went just completely dead.
Mm.
After about January 5th, we went through a 3 or 4 week period where we barely had a single sound detection, no sightings, and it was very depressing. We haven't had a really good sighting lately, but our sound detections are picking up. Both human observers are hearing these birds, hearing putative Kents and double knocks, and the listening stations are starting to regularly detect double knocks and putative Kent calls.
That's why I opened this up, talking about the fact that spring is in the air, because that's when anyone who knows about birds, that's when things really start to happen in all respects in terms of territorial displays and calls and mating and things. Are you noticing numerically an increase in your observations?
Yeah, since say even into the first week of February, it was pretty slow. But in the last week or 10 days, things have picked up quite a bit. Like I said, searchers are hearing what they think sound like Kents and double knocks, and the listening stations are recording Kents and double knocks.
If it's going to happen, it's probably going to happen about this in this next months ahead here.
In terms of getting a picture, it could happen anytime,
any
day of the year. But it could be actually be the hardest while the birds are nesting, unless we actually find the nest, which we hope we do. Then it'll be easy. You know, one bird will be in the nest incubating, and it maybe will restrict the bird's movement. I don't know. Nesting could actually slow us down to some degree. I think the time when we're most likely to get a picture is if these birds fledge young. When they have newly fledged young in the forest, that's when they should be most vulnerable to being approached.
Right. There's a learning curve.
Yeah, well, you know, parents get pulled into awkward situations by their kids all the time, and the kids are always doing stupid things. So it should be that situation. Very naive birds the parents are trying to watch out for. It should make the parents vulnerable to being approached, and the naive bird should be the most vulnerable to being approached.
One can only hope that they have some sort of protective behavior such that if you enter an area where the young are out, they're going to want to come over and divert you or something like that.
Definitely do that. I don't think the young will leave the nest till they fly very well, so it won't be like helpless young on the ground. It'll be a group of ivory bills moving, but the young should make mistakes. Move, let the observers get too close, maybe fly towards the observers out of curiosity. Parents are going to need to direct them away, and hopefully these kind of situations will give us photo opportunities.
Yeah.
I don't think, I mean, it's a dream that's never going to happen, that there'll be a basically helpless baby ivory bill on the ground and the parents are coming in trying to protect it and we're getting all sorts of pictures. When these birds leave the nest, they can fly very well, but they won't have experience and they will make mistakes.
Well, I've seen the way parental birds are very, very protective about their
brood. Oh, yeah. You know. We expect that from ivory bills.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like some interesting time ahead here. I know that you've, in the past, been posting a lot of this information on your website. Why don't you tell people where they can go to learn about this? And also, what are your plans for sharing this information, which you've done a nice, the newest information. When can we see some of those results?
If we get a definitive photograph, we're not going to be able to announce it immediately because this will be a big event in the conservation of this bird. And such a picture would have to go through careful scrutiny by experts and then go through peer review into a journal before it would be announced.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what's going on in our daily search, I do post updates about every week or every 2 weeks on our website, and that is www.auburn.edu/ivorybill, all one word, ivorybill.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an updates link in there, and you can see the past updates. And about every week or so, I post a new statement of what we've been seeing and hearing.
I took a look, and it was very interesting to see how things are beginning to increase about this time of the year in terms of the sightings and the double knocks and Kent calls and things.
And there's a link on my page to Dan Mantle's webpage. Dan just posted some sound clips that were recorded on a video camera by one of our volunteer searchers, and I think it's a really interesting series of potential Kent calls.
Oh, that's
so
great.
The listeners can go to Dan's page and listen. That was just posted a few days ago.
Oh, I missed that one. Okay, that's great. Well, let's say that there are ivory billed out there and you finally get the definitive pictures and the proof.
Yeah.
What happens then?
Well, as I said, we will, if we're confident that we've got a truly definitive picture, there will be no argument from woodpecker experts. We will verify that by showing it to various bird identification and woodpecker experts. Then, when we reach that level of confidence, we'll submit it to a journal, a science journal. So it will go out for peer review. If it passes peer review, it'll get published, and that would be the announcement point.
Mm-hmm. I guess my concern is that birders, wonderful people, but everyone wants to see the bird, and just the public at large would want to see this. How in the world are you going to try to keep the birds from being overloved or?
Well, we won't give away our locations, our exact locations where we're working. This is a very big area, and it can be a very tough area to work in. As a matter of fact, it's pretty dangerous. The river, it doesn't have rocks and rapids. It's on the coastal plain, but it water moves fast. There's lots of trees and logs in the water.
Mm-hmm.
A skilled canoeist or kayaker would have little trouble in this area, but the problem is birders will get themselves in trouble by climbing in a canoe or kayak where they have no skill, getting out on that river and getting themselves in trouble.
If people haven't been on some fast water in a kayak or canoe, they got something to learn because it takes you.
That's right. And logs are really dangerous. I mean, the water sweeps into a log,
It'll
turn your boat over in a hurry, and then you're in this very cold, fast-moving water. A very dangerous situation. Also, the this woods is big. It's 2 miles wide or so in most places, and it's a big 2 miles because it's all swamps and channels and very confusing. We don't mind people coming down to view this amazing swamp wilderness. I suggest 7 areas to search on my website that wouldn't interfere with our search whatsoever.
Okay.
www.auburn.edu/ivorybill. There's a link there that says advice to searchers. We would love it if somebody got a picture of this thing. We're trying hard in our study sites, but I encourage other bird watchers to come in and get that picture for us. It would do us an enormous favor.
Well, that's interesting that you can use people's help.
Yeah, just they come right in on top of us. It's not very helpful, but it's a huge swamp bottomland forest in there, and other searchers are useful.
And what they need to do is have a good camera and be sure that it's working.
Yeah, no more excuses. We got enough excuses for why we didn't get the picture. We need the darn picture.
Well, Dr. Hill, thanks so much for lending your voice here and all your thoughts and your hard work and your spirit on the Wild Side News.
Okay, Sydney, it's nice talking to you.
Yeah. Passion rocks. It's great to be rational, intelligent, and just quirky enough to live life as if it really matters. Our quest for the passionate warriors now takes a turn inward as we head on up near the Canadian border where a nature writing conference is planned. The passions of the written word, when your voice of the earth continues, following this very important message. Listen.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Here's a prediction. And for all of you who scribbled on your thoughts on paper or commit them to digitals and the vast unknowns of your hard drives, inspired by the realms of wonder, we're about 2 years off from a vast resurgence of popularity for great nature writers around the world. I've said it. Now you'll just have to wait and see. But in the meantime, you just may wish to plan to hone those skills in the wildlands of Vermont at the Wild Branch Writing Workshop. It's coming up. Take notes. One of the phenomena of being someone who likes the outdoors, and this applies to almost everybody I know, is that when you spend time in the wild, for whatever reason that is, you simply want to write about it. There's probably more writers per capita in this area of interest than possibly any other. There's something about sitting and looking out over a lake or taking a hike and resting and or whatever it is that makes people want to write. And so the legacy of writers in nature goes back actually many hundreds of years. And as we head into the 21st century, this just seems to be by human nature, we wish to write. Well, some people do it for many reasons, one for pleasure. Some people wish to actually do more with it, to professionalize their craft. A wonderful workshop is being scheduled in June in Vermont that really focuses on those people who wish to become much better writers and to improve their craft. And to talk about that now is David Brown, who's the director of the Wild Branch Writing Workshops. David, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, you're in Vermont. Is this the place of your birth, or have you moved there by choice, or how is it that you find yourself in Vermont?
I'm not from Vermont initially. I moved here in 1974, to a couple years out of college, to work at what's now Sterling College, and I worked there for over 20 years, and during that time got started with Wild Branch, and I've more or less retired from working at Sterling, but I still continue to organize and run Wild Branch each year.
Now, how many years has the Wild Branch Writing Workshop been operating?
This will be our 20th session, so that's somewhat of an accomplishment.
Sterling College seems to have a focus on nature writing. How is it that Sterling ended up with that focus?
Well, the college itself doesn't really have a focus on nature writing, but it's had a long interest in and focus on sort of the outdoors and the environment. And it began as a boys' prep school back in the late 50s, and then went through sort of an evolution and had an alternative year program sort of between high school and college in the early 70s, and then it became a two-year college, and then in the late 90s became a four-year college, and now offers a bachelor's degree in a number of fields such as conservation ecology, outdoor education and leadership, sustainable agriculture, and so on. So the primary focus at Sterling is on the outdoors and the environment, those sorts of things.
Very interesting. And what size faculty is there?
The total student body is on the order of 100,
mm-hmm.
roughly. So it's small, something on the order of 15, 16 faculty. Some of those are part-time and so on, but it's a pretty high ratio faculty to students.
Good. Let's focus on the Wild Branch Writing Workshop. First of all, let's get through and talk about some of the details. When is it going to be held?
It's scheduled this year for the week of June 3rd through 9th.
And in Vermont, that should mean that the forests are exploding in green.
The leaves are well out by that time of year.
Right. Well, it's just, I guess maybe my impression is it's an explosion of green. It's just dense with life.
It is.
Yes. Now, in terms of the workshop itself, we're going to do this for a week. There's an application process. We'll talk about that. What's the focus? Why should someone decide that they want to participate in the Wild Branch Writing Workshops?
Well, I think the workshop is really for people who have an interest in the outdoors, first of all, a love for the outdoors, and are also interested in writing and enjoy writing and interested in improving their writing. So we get, a mix of people. Many of the people that come are professionals that work for a variety of resource-related agencies. They can be local or state or, in some case, federal agencies. In other cases, they're nonprofit organizations, people that write professionally as part of their work. And then we get some people who simply come because they enjoy keeping a journal for themselves. Many people have published already. Other people are interested in learning how to go about publishing. Other people come and really have no interest in publishing whatsoever. They enjoy writing and enjoy the opportunity to work with other people and to improve their writing during the week.
Now, when it comes to nature writing, there's as I look back, sort of three general areas. One is kind of the historic descriptive writing that used to be so popular, for example, in Great Britain for such a long period of time. And then it seems with Henry David Thoreau and Emerson and Whitman and Muir, for example, there became a much more emotional and spiritual description of nature, which I think a lot of people relate to as the form that we respond to so dramatically. And then as well, there's the kind of the outdoor and recreation. Which of those are you going to be focusing on, or will you be involved in sort of all three?
Well, some extent, all of those. There'll be four residential faculty members this year, and each of them has a slightly different background and a slightly different focus. The students will choose one of those four instructors with whom to work each morning during the week, and then they'll have daily writing assignments. So to some extent, students can do the kind of writing that they're interested in doing. You know, they're not channeled in here and said, okay, you need to write whatever.
That's what I would expect. You can't force someone to write something they don't want to write about. But talk a little bit about the faculty that you have, and then you'll as well have some visiting faculty, and it's a very impressive group of writers.
The residential faculty for this summer will be Allison Deming. She's a professor of writing at the University of Arizona. Another fellow is named Eric Reese. He's from the Southeast, and he's a writer in residence at the University of Kentucky. Scott Vanders lives in Indiana, and he'll be one of the faculty. And then the fourth person is a woman named Sandra Steingraber, who lives in western New York State, and she's a visiting scholar at Ithaca College. So those will be the primary instructors. Emerson Blake and Jennifer Son, who are both with Orion Magazine, will also be here for the entire week as well. And they'll be working with on an individual basis with students and manuscripts that they might have.
And I must say, Orion is one of the co-sponsors of this event, and I think Orion provides some of the best writing on a regular basis, Orion Magazine, online, and the magazine itself. If people aren't familiar with Orion, they need to be, because this is where we get a full matrix, everything from investigative work, political commentary, to some of the best nature writing itself that you're going to find all wrapped up every month in Orion Magazine.
It's an exceptional organization, and we feel fortunate to have them involved with it.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the publisher, Chelsea Green, again, one of my favorite. It goes way beyond nature. It's Earth Publishing, and has such a broad spectrum in terms of the books that they publish. They're also going to be participating.
Correct. Chelsea Green has been sending someone for probably, 15, 16, 17 years.
Oh,
we've
wow.
had someone or other coming from that organization to talk mm-hmm. about book publishing.
The resident faculty and the visiting faculty really provide a strong basis for people to make professional advancements and personal advancements in their writing. Talk about what the, you know, kind of how this event will happen. It's a week. People can actually stay at the facility there. Give us a sense of what they could come to expect.
It's a small workshop. I mean, I've talked with some people, and they've been to writing workshops, and, you know, I ask how many people are there, and they say, oh, hundreds. And at Wild Branch, we have around 30 participants total, and six or eight faculty. And so it's very small, informal. The great majority of people stay on campus in the college dormitories, eat our meals in the college dining hall, so you spend a very close week with all of the faculty and with all the other participants. Not to diminish the expertise of the faculty in any way, the participants often say that they get as much from the other participants as they do from the faculty. We just seem to get a really interesting and varied group of people coming. But the students spend each morning with one of the four residential faculty members, and they'll do some readings, they'll critique each other's work, go over stuff, each for probably 3 hours each morning, and then have an assignment for the following day. In the afternoons and evenings, there are a series of other sessions scheduled that are by visiting faculty, and those could be on topics such as what's involved in book publishing or what's involved in magazine work. We'll have one this year on for the first time on internet publishing. Janice Ray will give a talk on sort of activism, and then another sort of a round table presentation on the business aspects of writing. If people are interested in sort of writing as a business or as a supplemental income, it'll be an opportunity for people to ask questions about all of the various business aspects of writing. So over the years, I feel like we've come to a very good balance between scheduled time of classes and open time for people to interact with other faculty and the participants, go on bird walks in the morning, and also do their own writing. They need a good chunk of time every day to write, and that's the primary reason that people come.
Since you've had such a long legacy of being involved in these workshops, I'm just curious, in terms of the participants that come there, literally the writing form, I think in many cases, how a person writes. Some people like to write in longhand. Some people may have computers. Because these are nature people, you can't necessarily take a computer out. For people who will be participating, is there any sort of criteria on how that's done so that it can be more easily shared? Do you have to do this on computer, or can you do longhand, or what's kind of the mix there?
We do have people every year who come, and they're still writing stuff out longhand, exactly. And some people will bring laptops with them. The participants have access to Sterling's facilities, and we have computers and things available in the library. So if people don't want to lug their own computers all the way here, they can use basically computers in Sterling libraries. So it varies, but there are no requirements. If people want to write stuff out longhand, they're welcome to.
Yeah, because I know that for myself, I've become a pen freak, simply because when I find the perfect pen, I will be able to write brilliantly. Unfortunately, I haven't found that perfect pen yet, but I've had some moments where I've had the right pen in my hand. There is an application process and a deadline. Let's talk about some of those specifics for people who have an interest, and also who should be applying, and should people feel as if they shouldn't because they're not ready?
I think the main interest or the main requirement is that someone have an interest in the outdoors, in the natural world, and love writing and be interested in improving their writing. We have, I say, quite a mix of people, from people who are well published, people who are editors for publications as part of their work, people who are, in some cases, writing instructors. But we also have people who've never published a thing and have simply kept a journal for many, many years and enjoy doing that. So, you know, there are no hard and fast requirements along those lines. People really just need to have an interest. The application process is fairly straightforward on the website. There's an application that asks basically for some background information, asks for either a resume or a brief outline of people's experiences, and then a short writing sample.
Now, short, that can be really intimidating to some people, because some people want to be exponential about their writing. So how do you interpret short?
A couple hundred words, a page, two pages, something like that.
Okay. In terms of the application process, where do they go?
They get sent to Sterling, and then we will essentially we won't do anything until after the March 15th deadline, and then we have a couple weeks. I think we say we'll try and notify people by April 10th so that people can begin to make travel plans and so on. The website.
Well, I have www.sterlingcollege.edu. And that's STERLINGCOLLEGE, and then forward slash, then capital A, capital D, period, Wild Branch, I'll say that again, wildbranch.html. Now, if you go to there, and I'll have a link on the show page as well, but does that sound right?
That does, and if you just, with a search engine, if you just do Wild Branch Writing Workshop, that'll get it too.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is a fee.
Tuition for the... for the week is $750, and if people choose to stay on campus, there's an additional $250, which is room and board. People have the option of staying off campus if they want in a local inn or bed and breakfast, but that will end up costing, obviously, a lot more than the $250. And I actually tend to discourage people from staying off campus just because they miss out on a lot of the interaction that takes place and sort of around the edges of the official stuff. I think the people that stay off campus, they end up with certainly a fancier room than they'll get at Sterling, but I think they miss out on some of the other stuff that happens.
The creative writing process can only benefit from interaction with lots of other creative people who are involved in the same thing. We all tend to help ourselves to other people's ideas graciously oftentimes as writers because it helps us become better, and that's kind of what these processes are about. You learn so much, and you don't have to necessarily learn from an expert, but they certainly can help the craft. It's like any other art form.
Right.
Go to someone who really knows this, and they give you insights into where you're going right and going wrong, and sometimes that's a little tough for almost any creative person, and in particular writers who have their sacred words. But nevertheless, if you can get past that, this sounds like an extraordinary event, and I wish I could be there myself, but I'm probably not going to be able to. But I certainly encourage listeners to contact you, and we're talking with David Brown, who is the director of the Wild Branch Writing Workshops that's going to be held in Vermont. Why don't you tell people kind of where this is, too, in Vermont?
Well, Craftsbury Commons in north central Vermont. We're about an hour and a half from Burlington, an hour north of Montpelier, about 40 minutes or so south of the Canadian border. So up in the northern part of the state, northern part of the Green Mountains. A lot of it's a rural landscape, a nice mix of agricultural fields and a mix of northern hardwoods and a kind of a spruce fir forest. We're sort of on the edge of the boreal forest, so we have a lot of the spruce and fir as well. So it's a nice mix of landscapes.
Well, David Brown, director of the Wild Branch Writing Workshops, I want to thank you so much and wish you great success on your upcoming event that's happening in June, but the deadline, that's why we're covering this now, is March 15th, which is my birthday, so I'll keep that in mind. But anyways, I encourage people to go ahead and take a chance. I know that it would be an exciting week and very productive. David Brown, thanks so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
You're welcome. Thanks for your interest.
Yes, if you love nature, you just may sense your bling rising in the years ahead. We are the voice and soul of the future. Believe it, live it, speak it, feel it, say it, do it. There's power in the passion. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives. When your passion finds voice encircling the earth, here on the Wild Side News.